Welcome to this episode of the Here and Now podcast. My name is Dave Mons. I'm a student of psychology and philosophy and a professional pilot. My aim is to share big ideas from science and the humanities to get you thinking and to help you make sense of the world. We continue our exploration of power in this third part of the series, which will depart from the traditional conceptions of power we introduced in the last episode. There, we talked about the historical view of power as something held by a king or religious figure, and how both the king and his subjects had a role to play in the manifestation of power. A king who provides resources and security may also be corrupt, but the people will tolerate a level of bad behaviour providing their needs are sufficiently met. However, when the leader rules through coercion and force, the people will eventually revolt, yet the pattern of revolution, consolidation, physical enforcement, legitimacy, inequality, and revolution repeated throughout history is one which is largely absent from the corporate and political structures embedded within global society today. While it may appear that society continues to uphold traditional power hierarchies, power is no longer something vested in the individual. It is this theme that we're going to explore in this episode. We concluded the last part with the message embedded within William Golding's classic Lord of the Flies and the conception of society as the basis of power, and that is where we pick up the story. Just as in traditional power structures, society stands in as the substitute for the king, but in a far less visible way. Power has a certain legitimacy. It is functional, non-dominant, and it is dialectic, meaning it is the convergence of opposing views or opinions. 19th century German philosopher Georg Hegel, whose work would become highly influential in 20th century philosophy and politics, put forth the notion of a master-slave dialectic, which can be applied to this conception of power. Prominent British sociologist Anthony Giddens describes this as a tension between the individual and society. Collectively, people make society, but they are also constrained by it. Power in this conception is so diffuse that one can neither observe it directly nor alter it in any meaningful way without drawing it to the surface. Power is embedded intangibly within social systems themselves. This notion or conceptualization of power began to emerge in the second half of the 20th century through the sociological framework of postmodernism. Jean-François Lyotard was a French philosopher and sociologist who spent a lot of time thinking about power and what it means for society. He was part of the postmodern revolution, which reconstructed the historical narrative of society into what he called master discourses or meta-narratives. These are totalizing stories about history which ground the conduct and actions of humanity to their contemporary time periods, linking them together in a continuous, positive flow towards social and intellectual enlightenment. Lyotard said we take for granted the notion that life today is better than it once was, that the structures and systems of society have been getting better over time. We no longer fight tooth and nail for survival. We no longer conduct human sacrifices to malevolent gods. We no longer draw and quarter those who resist the rules of social order. We have evolved, we are civilized, we are rational. Through science and technology, we have achieved these things. Traditional power structures no longer exist. We elect those in power. We have rights and freedom. We're the masters of our destiny. We have learned how to behave, how to be a society. We are not barbarians and savages. We are men and women. We are human beings, one step removed from God. This all sounds good, but the problem is, Lyotard and his postmodernism contemporaries thought this whole meta-narrative was bullshit. At the heart of this rejection of the prevailing meta-narrative is the question posed by Lyotard, which is, who decides what knowledge is, and who knows what needs to be decided? Why does knowledge matter here? What does knowledge have to do with history and our understanding of it? This is where power comes in. You may have heard the phrase, knowledge is power. This is almost a byline for postmodernist thinking. Knowledge is power. Think about that. What is it really saying? Consider this analogy. I step off the plane in a new country, one I've never been to before. I don't know its history or customs. I don't speak its people's language. I'm not familiar with the social norms. When I arrive, I bring with me, aside from my bag and personal belongings, my own personal history in micro-narrative form, my version of the wider meta-narrative instilled in me through the culture of my country and its institutions. My concept of morality, of what is right and wrong, of how to behave, essentially all of the tools I use to live in the world day by day. But these are quite different to those of the country I have now arrived in. The toilets are not composed of a bowl, a seat, a cistern, and a roll of paper, but rather a hole in the ground and a hose. The people walk on a certain side of the pavement. They even stand on a particular side on the escalators. They make eye contact differently. Men hold hands. Women wear coverings over their faces and bodies. Food is displayed in the open air. Even the sirens of the emergency vehicles sound different. I'm surrounded by contrary and unfamiliar rituals, customs and behaviours that challenge almost everything I brought with me. My very conception of right and wrong is in question. It all looks wrong to me. But it is not here. Why? Here, I have no knowledge of society. I don't know what is important to know. I don't know how to behave. With each misstep, I draw attention to myself as an outsider. I demonstrate to all and sundry that here, I have no power. I am socially outside of society. So I set out to find what these rules are and why they exist. I approach a man at a market stall. "Excuse me, good sir, can you direct me to the person who makes the rules, please?" He looks at me quizzically, notwithstanding the language barrier, and motions to a nearby colleague for support. The colleague approaches and looks at me with the same bemused expression, eyebrows raised, questioning.
Yes, I'm trying to find the person around here who makes the rules, you see. I'd like to learn the knowledge you people have so I can fit in a bit better, feeling a bit awkward and all that. Can you help?"
"What do you mean by knowledge?" the man asks.
"Well, you all seem to act in strange ways, well, strange to me at least. So there must be somewhere these are written, a set of customs and practices, norms if you will, and there must be someone doing the writing of these things, yes?"
"Ah, I see," the man replies, beginning to cotton on. "As it happens, when I'm not attending to these dates in my market store, I'm a philosopher, and I think you are mistaking knowledge with a capital K for knowledge with a small one. You see, there is knowledge like this date here. They are all about this size and colour. They grow in a palm tree. They taste delicious. Here, try one."
He takes a date from one of many bowls piled high with the brown fruit, decorating his stall, and hands it to me. I contemplate the date and pop it into my mouth. The taste is sweet, the flesh soft and sticky.
"So now you know about dates," he says. "But the knowledge you are referring to, the one with a capital K, I can't teach. In fact, no one curates it, and no one attends to it. It is everywhere. It is in everything, as you can see. He has it. So does he. That child, she has some of it. It is like the air around us. Do you understand?"
I ponder this man's words as I chew on the sweet date and realize what he is saying. The date tastes sweet, and I know this. We all know this. This knowledge is universal. It is knowledge with a capital K. The date would be sweet whether I am here to taste it or not. But this knowledge I am looking for, the knowledge he speaks of, is also in everything. It is culture, but it is more than that. It is history, reduced to social structures which exist beyond any independent constructions of it. It is it. Those who have it, who understand it, have the power to use it, and those who do not have nothing. But this knowledge is not the same as the taste of the date. If we were all to disappear in a moment, that knowledge would go with us, yet the date would remain. The knowledge is not really knowledge, not in the capital sense. It is invented, but not invented by anyone. It is contributed to, built upon, assimilated, conceived of,
mutually agreed, although no one convened a meeting to decide it. It just is.
I think I do understand, I reply.
But don't worry, he offers. If you stay here long enough, you'll get it too.
Lyotard looked at these forms of knowledge and power as structural, extending beyond the traditional hierarchical conceptions we are most familiar with, to be manifest within all institutions and ideologies of society. But more than this, because they exist in their time, they are not cognizant of their place in history. They simply reflect a knowledge structure that exists in the here and now. The notion that knowledge is continuous and connected throughout history, each phase building upon the last, slowly moving toward a higher state of being, is an illusion that emerges from the conception of human history as a series of meta-narratives, and one of these is the knowledge of science.
Science, Lyotard argues, is the great arbiter of knowledge. Science gives us knowledge with a capital K. Another way of saying this, which is commonly used in philosophy, is that knowledge discovered by science is truth, truth that exists in the universe with or without us, truth with a capital T.
Science and its practitioners literally tell us what is real, what is true, and through this implicitly, what to think and how to think about it. Power, therefore, lies within those institutions which dictate modern, secular society.
We're moving into new territory here, so it is time to bring a new character into the narrative, a contemporary of Lyotard, and one of the central provocateurs of postmodernism and poststructuralism, Michel Foucault. Michel Foucault was a flamboyant French philosopher and intellectual who did not like being labelled or categorised, so it is somewhat ironic that his ideas are so closely associated with a particular philosophical movement. Foucault belonged to an intellectual elite in France that emerged in the mid-20th century, which set out to question the historical narrative from which modern institutions and norms had arisen. Key pillars of society, like the medical system and hospitals, our perceptions of mental health and treatment of those so afflicted, the education system, and the judicial systems of discipline and punishment. Foucault approached these systems from a perspective that challenged the prevailing historical narrative. He dug deeper and questioned whether the evolution of society was not about increasingly sophisticated technologies that free people from their barbaric natures, but a gradual yet pervasive reconceptualization of power that, through subtle means, became the underlying, self-serving basis for how all social systems operate and are sustained. There is quite a lot to unpack here. I'd like to draw on a little of podcaster Stephen West's work. Stephen hosts the Philosophize This podcast, which does excellent treatment to many famous philosophers and their work. His work on Foucault is excellent and served as a great introduction for me. I hope one day I might get to speak with him directly, but for now, here is what Stephen West had to say about Foucault and his conceptualization of power. Foucault demonstrated that things which most people assume were necessary truths are ultimately subjective, contingent, and rooted in history. What we think of as truth is often nothing more than the dominant narrative of the time in which we are living. When he talks about truth here, West is talking about knowledge, that which we take for granted. Foucault looked at power as one of these misunderstood truths. The traditional view we talked about earlier, or a single source of dominant power which tells us how we should behave and sets limits on what we can and can't do. Power conceptualized in this way is repressive. It establishes social contracts on our time, our money, our very freedom. And indeed, that was the nature of power for a substantial part of human history. It was when philosophers like Immanuel Kant came along that even these strictures were called into question. Kant, who you may remember from several previous episodes, was the ideal ideologue. Morality was his thing. For him, freedom was a moral imperative for humanity, an innate right and a starting point from which all dictates of society must stem. Power infringes upon the individual's right to not be constrained by another's choices. But Foucault would shout from the pages of his books and in his lectures, "Stop! This is not the truth." For Foucault, the traditional view of power was naive and overly simplistic. Modern society is far more complex, and power influences populations in subtle and indirect ways. He described the diffuse, omnipresent nature of power as capillary, like the innumerable veins and vessels that traverse the body, power flows through society, reaching every pocket and corner. It is meta. It connects and controls the norms of society, and we are almost entirely unaware of its presence, yet we are complicit with it. Embedded within this conception of power is the realization that it has no direct control, not in the traditional sense. It is no source beyond the structures within which it exists. This is a fascinating and intriguing notion to think about. Just as Hegel described a dialectic relationship between master and slave existing in the embattled minds of all of us, power is intrinsically connected to society. It needs no form of direct control because it is its very subjects who maintain its influence. What then are the methods that power utilizes? It is embedded within culture, within norms, within social behavior, knowledge, and the institutions which give rise to it. Foucault realized that true power is not coercive, it is influential, but it requires freedom. That is, true power is the power that exists when individuals have a choice, but the choices they make are influenced by the society in which they live. But I keep speaking about society as if it is one thing, something tangible we can put in a box and examine. But society is a collection of many things. It is the collective assemblage of our social world, the things we take for granted, that form and shape how we conduct ourselves. It is what we turn to when we need things, things like law and order, healthcare, education, information, entertainment, help, and even love. All of these institutions exist in a social epoch that defines the limits and extent of their power and how it is manifest. This is a tacit relationship, negotiated through subversive means, which we agree to through our acceptance of the norms that govern our behavior. We are born into them. Our parents teach them to us at first, and then our schools and our friends, eventually our colleagues and the media. They are all around us. We hardly notice these bases of power until we or someone else comes up against them. Then they become obvious. Let's take Q's, for instance, what I consider to be the ultimate social experiment. Q's offer an insight into the norms of a society and a window into the soul of those who inhabit it. Firstly, is there a queue at all? In some countries, people will naturally form an orderly queue. One person will stand behind the other, a comfortable distance apart, respecting their own and the other's personal space. Then another joins, and so too follows the ritual. As one person moves forward, the rest follow in an elegant elephant walk as if choreographed. Yet this behavior is not natural. It is learned. It is a social norm, a rule for how to act in the world. Then a newcomer arrives, and they don't move to the end of the queue. They're in a hurry. They think their needs are more important than those of the others. They rush to the front. They step ahead of the first in line and wave their important papers in front of the teller, demanding attention. Is there a security guard or a policeman standing by, ready to intervene in this situation? No, there really ever is. Why? Because the first in line, and probably the one behind, will quickly scold the queue jumper, informing them of the social norm they have breached, reminding them of the correct way to behave, and ensuring they are publicly shamed for their indiscretion. The newcomer hangs his head and walks to the back of the queue, taking up his place, regretful of facing the scorn of a society who knows the rules, a society which holds the collective knowledge of how to behave and the power to uphold its values. Yet in another place, the queue is an abstract concept. There, people congregate. They shout and push and negotiate for who has the right to be first, whose needs are most important. The harried teller makes no judgments. She lets the pack organize themselves according to their own requirements. May the best queuer win. And so it goes. Power is embedded in how we choose to behave when we think we have a choice. Foucault would argue we are all blind to these norms, to this power over us, that there is no such thing as common sense. We take it for granted that how we behave is a form of power that we did not get to negotiate. When it comes to cues, we can easily see that the power of norms are their natural self-organizing properties. They allow us to live together and balance fairness across large groups. Power is not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, maybe it is never a bad thing. But what we are talking about is not a judgment of power. It's an understanding of what it is and how it is manifest. So let's just keep that in mind. The conception of power as a negative is a hangover from our traditional conceptualization of the dominant, coercive, hard power that once ruled the earth. Today, power is a social glue, as Gounod described it. It has a much more neutral quality. But, as always, that is a matter of perspective. So things will take a slightly more sinister turn here, as we move into the crux of Foucault's work on power. We return to the power-knowledge relationship. We know now that power in the modern world lies not with individuals, with leaders and sovereigns, not really. It lies within society. But society itself is governed by its institutions. Let's take science as our example here, as it features heavily in Foucault's work. Simply put, science controls knowledge. It creates knowledge, it creates experts in that knowledge who discover things, categorize things, and generally tell us what's what. We naturally look to people in positions of authority for guidance. We commit their bidding as willing participants. That is how we are programmed. And we learned this from Stanley Milgram's obedience experiments. Science is as sacred an institution to modern society as the gods were to the ancient Egyptians. Science is our modern religion. As the purveyor of knowledge, science controls the discourse of value in life. Through science, life itself has become objectified and dissected into a million conceptual pieces. The body is perhaps the most studied and articulated aspect of life. Every piece, part, and pore has been named and connected to the others by an intricate web of systems and functions. Medicine is one of the great achievements of humanity, and at its centre is the human body. We are either one way or another, according to science and medicine. We are sick or we are healthy. When we have some disease, we become that disease. We are schizophrenic. We don't have schizophrenia. We are epileptic. We don't have epilepsy. The language we use to describe the body and its myriad illnesses and disorders are norms of society dictated to us by the institutions to which we turn to when things do not function as they should. Brian Turner, another British sociologist, writes, "The law, as well as medicine and religion, have been described as institutions of normative coercion. The term coercion refers to their function of surveillance over everyday life and their discipline of the individual, and as much as actions can be seen to be both produced and limited by them. However, this is not to say that they are coercive in the sense of explicit threats to achieve obedience. It is more insidious than that. This is because we readily accept these normative institutions as having the legitimate moral authority to define individual problems and provide solutions." I have to make a comment here. I'm not condemning medicine or science. You know that I'm a proponent of it, and I'm starting to become a practitioner of it through psychology. But it is through this type of learning, what I'm talking about here, that I've come upon this conceptualization of power, and I'm finding it fascinating. So the purpose of exploring these topics is not to take things for granted, is to think about how things are or how we perceive them to be, and to ask ourselves those deeper questions about why. Why are things the way they are? Foucault called the power embedded within social institutions biopower, literally power over life. He described biopower is an explosion of numerous and diverse techniques for achieving the subjugation of bodies and the control of populations. Well, it's a heavy thing to say. But the insidious way biopower acts is through the mechanism of social influence. Power acts upon us almost from the inside out, and this leads to an incredible realization that the further we explore the nature of humanity, the nature of human nature, the more we uncover and encode within an institutional language. And as a result, the truth about human beings we uncover, psychologically, sexually, spiritually, serves to create the very types of people that it purports to discover. I'll say that again, because I think it is an important concept which is really central to Foucault's work. And this is paraphrased from Anne Ryan's brilliant doctoral thesis, which says that the methodologies, practices, and concepts that attempt to uncover the truth of human nature create the very types of people they purport to discover. Foucault called the language we use to describe reality, that defines and dictates how we see and act in the world, discourses. Our discourse is what gives rise to our reality. And our discourse is informed by the power structures embedded within society via our norms and values, which are in turn determined by our sources of knowledge, our institutions. Here I'll quote Foucault directly. Each society has its regime of truth, its general politics of truth. That is, the types of discourse it accepts and makes function as true. The mechanism and instances that enable one to distinguish true and false statements, the means by which each is sanctioned, the techniques and procedures accorded value in the acquisition of truth, the status of those who are charged with saying what counts as true. In modern society, power no longer carries with it the threat of death. Instead, it takes charge of people's lives, and it does so without tacit permission. We are focused on medicine and science, but this theme translates to many other social structures. Imagine what Foucault would have to say about social media. Social media is almost the ultimate extrapolation of power knowledge. For many of us, our social worlds exist predominantly online, where information and knowledge is controlled by society itself. If truth was a slippery concept before, then today it has lost all credibility at representing anything more than what one person says or thinks at a given time. Truth doesn't even have to be true. Yet there is so much power vested in the institutions which control the technology that this world exists upon. The algorithms which determine what shows up on your newsfeed, what tweets are at the top of your list, how many people will read your post, are designed and controlled by a handful of people running multi-billion dollar corporations. Even science is questioned on this platform. We no longer know who to trust because we can trust no one. If power is embedded within the structures that govern society, and those structures lose control of the knowledge they purport to control, society itself is destined to become lost. I think we are seeing that happen through social revolution that questions the prevailing narrative. But is that what is really happening? The irony of this conceptualization of power is that the capillaries of power run so deep that they allow the individual to adapt and to change, to create a new version of themselves that fits in with what society dictates is desirable. It therefore becomes almost impossible to tell the difference between reinventing power structures or simply restoring them, shifting them from one place to another. But does it matter? Probably not. Because power need not always corrupt. Power is not in and of itself a negative, sinister force. It just is. It is up to the individual and to society to reconcile the limits and extent to which power has influence. This narrative is ongoing. Perhaps we are witnessing a shift in that narrative right now. As Anna Goinet says, although social power can be negative and power holders can be corrupt, a science that explained only those dimensions of experience would necessarily be incomplete. If we are to develop a coherent and robust social psychology of power, it is necessary to look beyond this very part view. Power can also be seen as a universal, necessary, and even inevitable force. Without power, no collection of people would be able to accomplish any end. Michel Foucault died of AIDS in 1984, and in his final years, he turned to the individual as a truer source of power, but not in the traditional sense, more as a member of society. The individual is the subject of action and an important part of the power knowledge dyad, and so it is to the individual to which we'll turn next in the final part of our exploration of the concept of power.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Here and Now podcast. You can find us on Facebook at the Here and Now podcast or Twitter at Here Now podcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe to keep up to date with all of the latest episodes. And if you want to support the podcast, you can find us on Patreon or leave a review at the Apple Podcasts app. You can reach out to me via the pages or email theherenow@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.